Hello, Eases of Podcast listeners. This is Chris, the podcast Irish correspondent. You might remember that this is the voice that was rambling at you about James Connolly in the IRA last year. Cena is letting me take up space on his feed to plug a media venture that I have, Politics and Letters, which is a podcast about Irish history, literature, Marxism, and the national question. The newest episode, an excerpt from which I understand will be playing after I finish talking, is about the life and work of the Palestinian literary critic, activist, and all-round legend Edward Said. I hope you'll enjoy it enough to check out the full version, as well as future episodes I'll have on the Russian, German, and Irish revolutions. All right, thanks for your time. Bergi Bua, Slán Slán. For Cade Falchuk with Politics and Letters, where I talk to writers about their books on politics and or literature. On this episode, I'm talking to Conor McCarthy about the life and work of the Palestinian literary critic and activist Edward Said. Conor McCarthy is a senior lecturer at Maynooth University, and he's written two books, most germanely for the purpose of this interview, The Cambridge Introduction to Edward Said, but also Modernization, Crisis and Culture in Ireland, a critical study of the responses of Irish intellectuals to modernity and development from the late 60s to the early 90s. He's also edited a collection of the anti-imperialist writings of the Republican Socialist James Connolly for Edinburgh University Press, and I very much recommend that you check out any and all of these books if you're interested in following up on any of the topics which came up in the course of the interview. I started off by asking Conor to provide a rundown of Edward Said's family background or early life, and what it was that first brought him to the study of literature.
Yeah, Edward Said was... He lived most of his youth in Cairo, as you say, but he was born in Jerusalem in 1935. He was born in West Jerusalem to Palestinian parents. His father was a pretty successful Palestinian businessman who ran quite a large and I believe quite important stationery company with branches in Beirut and in Cairo as well as in Jerusalem. And Edward initially went to schools in Jerusalem, and in 1947 the family left Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, an area that they've been living in called Talbiya. They left Jerusalem for the last time, so that's a year before the emergence of the State of Israel in 1948, and they moved pretty much permanently to Cairo. Said's background, as I say, was pretty sort of unimpeachably middle class or bourgeois or upper middle class. I mean, the family was quite wealthy. Wadia Said had, in the 19-teens, emigrated to the United States, I'm pretty sure to avoid or evade the Ottoman army draft, the Ottoman Turkish army draft. And in fact, in the United States, where he spent some years, he eventually joined the United States Army, and he served with the American Expeditionary Forces during the First World War. And in a way that I can't specify, I'm not sure if it's in the Brennan biography, because of that army service, because of that living in the United States, Wadia Said became an American citizen. So when young Edward, who appears to have had a fractious relationship with teachers in various schools that he attended, when he was finally expelled from Victoria College in Cairo, maybe around 1950, when he was 14 or 15, his parents took the option that they had, because Edward was entitled to American citizenship too, of simply sending him to boarding school in the United States. So that's how he ended up in the United States, and he completed his education in an elite school in Massachusetts called Mount Hermon, and then he went on to Princeton and Harvard. I think Said was, as I say, a fractious and at times unhappy student. I don't think he always did that well in school. He describes in his memoir, Out of Place, which he published in 1999, I think, having had, particularly in Victoria College, a kind of stereotypical English or English colonial education. So let's say, you know, his study of literature was of English literature. And he was more acquainted because of that with classics and canonical figures from English literature than anything to do with the literature or culture of the world in which he was still at, you know, at Victoria College living. However, it should be said that in the memoir, Side made clear his evidently very intense and warm and important relationship with his mother. And his mother, of his parents, seems to have represented, if you want, the world of culture and affect and emotion and tenderness and the aesthetic to him, where his father, Wadia, was a kind of disciplinarian and a fairly stern sort of patriarch who was interested in Edward getting a good job and possibly training to be a doctor. But Edward Said's first cultural love was music. It was classical music. And in fact, he was taken to concerts by visiting and possibly Egyptian orchestras in Victoria from a relatively young age, in Cairo, excuse me, from a relatively young age. And he was also, he had intense one-to-one piano lessons. It's probably not the kind of piano lesson than a good one-to-one one. But anyway, in particular, in his memoir, he remembered a very brilliant Polish-Jewish teacher called Ignacy Tigerman. And I think he actually had a relationship, a friendship with Tigerman right up until Tigerman's death in the 1950s. And Edward trained and practiced and took the piano very, very seriously. And definitely there was a phase when he'd finished his undergraduate degree at Princeton, where he eventually specialized in literature and philosophy. But there was a phase when the potential for a career as a professional concert pianist was well open to him. It's ultimately, of course, an option that he didn't take. But music remained very important to him, as you'll know, right through his life. And it became more prominent in his writing in the last 20 years of his life. He became a music critic for The Nation, which is a venerable and often very good liberal left American magazine of some vintage. He became The Nation's classical music critic in 1986. And he started publishing academically about music just a couple of years later when he gave his Wellick lectures on classical music. His taste in music was, as I say, very canonical European classical music. It was never going to be. I don't think he was that interested in musical modernism. So he wasn't interested in European classical music experimentation of the 1920s, or, you know, that we'd associate with the world of Berg and Schoenberg and people like that. I would think that jazz and rock and roll and folk music were mostly off his register. They came to him through his children, to his family's amusement, but they were never tastes of his.
When was it that Said first began thinking about Palestine politically, and in what form does his activism initially take? And as well, did it ever open him up to criticism or even a certain amount of danger in his other public roles as a lecturer or as a literary journalist in more popular outlets?
Said used to say that his first real piece of Palestine-focused writing was an essay that he wrote, I think, about 1968, definitely in the wake of the Six-Day War. Which he lived through the Six-Day War as a Palestinian in New York, in a New York that he found, that he experienced as being overwhelmingly supportive of the Israeli victory in the Six-Day War. And in 68, I think, he wrote an essay called The Arab Portrayed. And The Arab Portrayed, although it uses a different kind of register and a different kind of vocabulary, clearly is in some ways the, not the root essay of Orientalism, but the first kind of writing about portrayals of Arab people and maybe Palestinians in particular that he would produce. However, it's worth saying that in Tim Brennan's recent biography of Said, by the time that Said would have written The Arab Portrayed, he was a He'd just received tenure at Columbia University. He was now an established younger academic. But Brennan's biography of Said shows that the young man, certainly as an undergraduate at Princeton, already had firmly held and firmly articulated views on the Middle East and on the situation of Palestinians. They just weren't getting published, but he was quite prepared to debate these things, to argue them with friends or fellow students at Princeton and so on. So a feeling of a degree of politicization clearly had preceded the publication of any writing, if that's not a contradiction. The writing really took off in the late 60s. But Columbia was big enough, and New York is certainly big enough and various enough for him to have found some allies. He did have allies, including political allies, on the faculty at Columbia. And it should be said that, nevertheless, you know, in the late 60s, the early 70s, he was mostly pursuing an increasingly successful, but if you want, arguably conventional career as a rising professor of literature, publishing a great many essays on, in particular, on the then emerging Anglophone interest in French theory. Obviously, some of that theory had a kind of political valence. I mean, you couldn't read a writer like Foucault without, you know, getting a whiff of some kind of politics. And you might say that that eventually emerged explicitly in a Said in Orientalism, which some people still think is a Foucauldian book. For a long time, Said used to use a phrase of himself that I think was used of Conrad, of Joseph Conrad, who, of course, was the focus for Said's PhD thesis and who was a writer that he was obsessed with right through his life. And at one point, people described, or someone described, or maybe Conrad himself described himself as a homo duplex. I presume that her term means like a bipartite human being, a person with two lives. And Said, who in many ways identified in some ways with Conrad, Said saw himself in a similar way, as someone who, on the one hand, was pursuing, in some ways, an unimpeachably professional and, as I say, rather conventional but very successful literary professorial career, and on the other hand, who, you know, went back on holidays back home to, no longer to Palestine, but to Cairo or to Beirut, and who was interested in the politics of that part of the world, and who, after the late 1960s, began to write about that part of the world. But for a long time, those two aspects of Said, he kept quite firmly separate from each other, if you want.
You touched briefly on there about how Said was an early advocate for methods associated with continental philosophy. The collection of thinkers most associated with what's referred to as the cultural turn in the study of literature, very simplistically, the movement from an appreciative or belletrist new criticism to the dispensation we have today, where the emphasis is very much on radical sociology or identity. What was the appeal of theory to Said, and what was the character of the opposition he faced in using it in his own criticism?
I think the appeal of theory was probably novelty. New, more, in some very general sense, politicized ways of looking at literature. Said was never part of the American literary critical establishment of the 50s. He was never a practitioner of the new criticism, which is a kind of, you know, as you know, a kind of rather unhistorical, intensely formalist, arguably aestheticist, arguably Kantian kind of criticism. Said's Conrad book was written under the influence of phenomenology and of a group called the Geneva School, who pressed ideas taken from Husserl and Heidegger, and maybe to a lesser extent from the French existentialists, into service in the study of literature. Now, mostly the Geneva School, whose main luminary was a writer called Georges Poulet, mostly the Geneva School, I think, were not that into, they weren't pursuing an overtly political criticism. But the watermark, if you like, of that initial interest in Geneva School criticism, which enabled Said, on the one hand, to evade certainly to evade or avoid Leavisism, to evade or avoid the New Criticism, but also positioned him slightly differently in the world of comp lit, in that it didn't make him, although he was intensely admiring of the great tradition of philology, the great German Romantic tradition of philology, it placed him slightly differently. And I suppose the background with the Geneva School criticism also made him always already open to new strands of European thought. In his memoir, he says that as a graduate student, he was already reading two major but not closely related figures who remained important for him for the rest of his career. One was the sort of proto-historicist Italian philosopher and jurist of the 18th century, Giambattista Vico, who remained a lifelong preoccupation and about whom he wrote essays, particularly in the 60s and the 70s. And the other was Georg Lukács, the Hungarian Marxist. Said tells us that he was reading History and Class Consciousness, which you'll know is probably Lukács' masterpiece and certainly the major text of his early career. And History and Class Consciousness and the early Lukács, and occasionally hints of the later Lukács, would pop up again at various points right across Said's career. In fact, my own kind of theory about Said's late reading of Adorno is that in some ways he was sort of late in his career. He was Adorno came to maybe replace Lukács for him. This is something we might talk about more later, but it was as if he was having been bitten and been infected by a Lukácsian disease. He was then inoculating himself with a dose of Adorno laterally in his career. Said was very taken with the Vichyan idea of the autodidact, so that Said might be picking up a bit of Vico here or reading some Lukács there, largely, I would suspect, off his own bat. That would be in character. Having said that, you know, when he first arrived in Colombia, he made friends with people like Fred Dupuy and Lionel Trilling, who were part of the ensemble that was called the New York Intellectuals. Some of the New York Intellectuals who clustered around a journal called Partisan Review, some of them, including Dupuy, had a background in Trotskyism. In other words, they were from the far left, and Said was particularly friendly with Dupuy, and Dupuy is meant to have introduced Said to forms of activism that maybe he mightn't have experienced before. So Said's positioning in regard to continental theory was always going to be, on the one hand, significant in that he was definitely a processor and a mediator of French structuralism and post-structuralism into the United States, in particular the work of Foucault. But his positioning, nevertheless, was always going to be somewhat uncomfortable. Tim Brennan, who again is, I think, a very particularly telling and interesting critic of Said, a friend, but also quite a stern critic at times. Brennan shows how in Said's first major theoretical book called Beginnings, which was published in 1975, on the one hand, Beginnings is deeply imbued with a fascination for and excitement about Foucault, Levi-Strauss, Bakhtin. At the same time, Beginnings makes almost frantic efforts to somehow reconcile the new French linguistic theory, or the new to Europeans French linguistic theory, with the great Romance philological tradition that Said, as a comparatist, had been partially trained in. So Said is trying to reconcile, I say it slightly crudely, Erich Auerbach with Foucault. These are not necessarily reconcilable figures, but they nevertheless, they represent sort of poles in his kind of critical or intellectual personality.
The work that most people will know Said for is Orientalism.
Yes.
A study of the ways in which societies in West Asia and North Africa were by turns romanticized, caricatured, stereotyped, and in overall terms figured as legitimate objects of domination in the West. Said conducted a series of close readings of important sources in which he regarded this ideology as most clearly manifesting itself. Could you talk a bit about the scope and content of Orientalism, how it was received both from the perspective of the pro-imperial Hatshepsuts, as well as the those coming from the more ostensibly left factions in the academy? Yes, yes. And actually, I'm particularly interested in a comment you just made where you said that most people think that Orientalism is kind of a Foucauldian work.
Yeah.
Is that your registering of a disagreement there? Or?
The way I first encountered Orientalism was that this was the best Foucauldian book that Foucault had not written. And in fact, rather shamefully, I don't want to go on about myself, but I first read Edward Said when I was an undergraduate or a late undergraduate as a kind of more accessible gloss on Foucault, because Foucault is not always accessible. Sometimes he's difficult. Whereas Said, even in his definitely academic work, has a kind of plain and mostly accessible style. He's really difficult to understand. Orientalism, one of the funny things that has happened in regard to Orientalism is that when Orientalism, when the word is now used, capitalized, it's now mostly used to refer to a book by Edward Said. But Edward Said's book was actually about an academic discipline or sub-discipline that for a long time had legitimacy in the Western, including the American Academy. One of the radical things that Said did in Orientalism was not only look at the genealogy of this academic discipline, which he brought back to the late 18th century, and the rise of modern linguistics and the association of cultural or even national or ethnic attributes with certain language types or language forms from Europe or from Middle Asia or elsewhere. But one of the most radical things that Said did was not only to offer a kind of polemical account of this academic discipline from Herder to Bernard Lewis, let's say, Bernard Lewis being a contemporary of Said's and an enemy of his. But Said broadened the term Orientalism out into a much larger, more expansive, even baggy kind of usage. So for Said, not only had these venerable and often phenomenally erudite philologists and linguistic scholars and historians of language that he was ostensibly focusing on, not only had they produced certain kinds of, let's face it, stereotypes of people from Near or Middle Asia, but Said also found the same kind of rhetorical patternings in creative writers, notoriously in radicals like Karl Marx, in journalists, in travel writers, in politicians, in sociologists and anthropologists. So in Said's hands, Orientalism became a very wide-ranging critique of the rhetorics by which Europeans had described the Near East. There are marvelous passages in Orientalism, passages that I still think are magnificent, in particular where he discusses major French writers of the 19th century writing about their travels in the Orient. So I'm talking about passages about Nerval, about Chateaubriand, about Lamartine, and in particular about Flaubert. And they're magnificent literary discussions, but there's a great deal more as well. And I think that's probably both one of the book's strengths and one of the ways that it's weak, or that it's certainly vulnerable, if you want. Critiques came of Orientalism thick and fast. Historians felt that Said was practicing a kind of weak or at times ignorant history. Foucauldians felt it wasn't Foucauldian enough. Marxists felt that he was offering a calumny on the reputation of Karl Marx. And Middle East area studies experts felt that Orientalism was simply a very elaborate expression of Arab nationalism wrapped up in the new fancy jargon of structuralism or post-structuralism. The most famous critiques, I think, would be those of Orientalists, like professional Orientalists who naturally, of course, wanted to defend their practice and defend their discipline, like Bernard Lewis. And I think the most famous, and I'll go back to Bernard Lewis in a second, the most famous critique from the left was the Marxist critique by the Indian writer Ijaz Ahmed, which I still think has not been exceeded, although I have a lot of disagreements with the way that Ahmed wrote about Said, and I can come to that. For someone like Lewis, I think Said, by using the Foucauldian concept of a discourse, by which I understand the idea that in a way taken from structuralist linguistics. Foucault basically says that academic disciplines, let's say, produce a body of ideas and a body of writing that has its own regularities, rules, consistencies, codes that supervene over the individuals who contribute to that discourse, and to some degree shape the individuals who contribute to that discourse. And for someone like Bernard Lewis, who I don't think was particularly interested in or trained in this so-called new theory, what this amounted to was basically a kind of conspiracy theory against particular and no doubt extraordinarily learned and no doubt actually also personally humane and decent individual figures in the history of Orientalist scholarship, including no doubt himself as well, because there is polemic against Bernard Lewis at the end of Orientalism. So Lewis was interested, Lewis and, you know, someone say writing after Lewis, like Robert Irwin, who's still alive and writing, they basically see, they don't like the way that Orientalism appears to cluster and group and generalize about a group of apparently very individualistic writers or scholars. The critique from Ahmad is more interesting to me because I'm, I suppose, personally, you know, maybe a little bit closer to the left side of these things, or to the left side of Said. Ahmad felt that Said didn't really have a coherent theory of empire. If he was suggesting that Orientalism was a discourse that legitimated and in some way or other participated in the creation of imperial hegemonies, Ahmad felt that Said didn't really have any, you know, fully worked up theory of imperialism. And although I would count myself as a kind of Said partisan, I think that Ahmad, in fact, is right. Said is not a Marxist. He, to be fair to him, he has clarified, or he did clarify, his positions vis-a-vis Marxism, and he never claimed to be a Marxist. He was never an unspoken Marxist. But for me, one of my problems with Said's writing would be that he didn't, he could name check, and I'm sure he'd read some of, but he never really wanted to use the fertility and the richness of Marxist thinking about empire from Lenin to David Harvey. So I think that, you know, Ahmad was annoyed and upset about that. He didn't like the way that Said could sort of veer as he did from, you know, talking apparently positively, you know, about a kind of, you know, French Republican centrist denouncer of intellectuals like Julian Benda, and in the next sentence, you know, invoke Gramsci or Raymond Williams or someone else like this. For Ahmad, this was simply inconsistent. And in some ways, I think, again, I give Ahmad, I think he probably is right that to some degree Said is not consistent. Said, in an essay published 5 years or 6 years after Orientalism came out called Secular Criticism, which is the lead essay in what I think is Said's best book. I don't think Orientalism is Said's best book at all. I think his best book is a collection of essays about literary critical politics called The World, the Text, and the Critic. And in the first essay of The World, the Text, and the Critic, Said says that he considers himself mostly to be influenced most by Marxists, but not by Marxism. And by that, it's not that this is some kind of extraordinarily subtle distinction, but it's an important distinction. Said is saying that he's read and he feels he has learned from Marxists, from Gramsci and Lukács, and the first generation of Western Marxism. And he's, in fact, he's written about Marxism himself as well, or coming up to Raymond Williams or Frederick Jameson. But he's not really interested in these people as being figures in a tradition, as representing a kind of lineage or, you know, developmental story of thought. Of course, you could say, slightly against Said and slightly ironically, that if he was interested in the internal continuities super individual lineages of Orientalism, he wasn't particularly interested in these things when it came to Marxism. Said felt that, he says in Secular Criticism, he felt that that a Marxism, an academic Marxism practice in the American Academy was just going to be academic, because it was not involved in some kind of Now, he said this without sort of maybe arguing for it, although I think he was, to some degree, probably right. A Marxism inside the academy in America, as far as Said was concerned, was not going to be, or was going to struggle to be, related to an actual politics on the street or of the trades union movement or of the labor movement beyond the academy. And I suppose he felt that, for a Marxist criticism to be properly true to itself, it would need to have that affiliation. Said was not above also offering, I suppose you'd say, really more a liberal kind of argument, saying that, you know, that to identify, for him to identify particularly or purely with Marxism was him to foreclose on other radical intellectual traditions. And, you know, at that point, he would invoke someone like Noam Chomsky, who's unquestionably a figure of the left, but is not and never was a Marxist. Chomsky's an anarchist. And indeed, on one or two occasions, Said professed a kind of sympathy for anarcho-syndicalism, although it's never developed. So on the one hand, I think that where I think that Ahmed really has Said is when it comes to empire, and empire is very important for Said, there's no doubt about that. But Said can't really explain why European power from the 1500s to the 21st century has wanted to project itself into other parts of the globe, of the global south. And in fact, personally, I have an argument that that the lack of interest in the Marxist tradition of explaining that pattern, or the lack of intellectual equipment inside for explaining it, is in some ways attributable to things that emerge as early as the Conrad and Phenomenology book. Because, of course, nowadays, partly because of Edward Said, although not only because of him, you know, we think of Conrad as the writer about empire, the creative writer about empire, par excellence. And yet Said could write a book about Joseph Conrad that was not concentrating on Conrad's relationship to empire. The theme pops up occasionally in the text of Joseph Conrad and the Fiction of Autobiography, but it is by no means a major theme.
You've mentioned already the individuals that populate the Marxist tradition that Said was interested in, names like Antonio Gramsci, Gregory Lukács, and Raymond Williams. I suppose I'm interested in, or what he found useful about individuals within the Marxist tradition who are situating themselves within that tradition without being within it themselves.
I think at different points in his career, Said was interested in Marxist writers or different Western Marxist writers. Again, we need to be clear about that. Said was never a Stalinist. He was never a member of the Communist Party. Having said that, he was also very highly attuned to the particular nasty and paranoid style of American anti-anti-communism, of anti-communism. So he was an anti-anti-communist, if you know what I'm trying to say. He had no time at all for anti-communism, which he always saw as having a hidden agenda, and as a kind of intellectual sleaziness. Marxist writers that he was interested in. He was interested in Lukács, he was interested in Gramsci, he was interested in Raymond Williams, although I sometimes think he was interested in Raymond Williams at a stage of Williams's career before Williams maybe had fully confronted Marxism. So I think that for Said, the great Williams book, and obviously Williams wrote many books, and they were friends. I mean, they weren't close to each other, but they were personal friends and they corresponded. But the Williams book that I think Said invoked most often was The Country and the City. Now, maybe I'm just revealing my ignorance of Raymond Williams, but I mean, Raymond Williams' primary confrontation with Marxism comes in a book that's published in 1980. It doesn't mean that Marxist categories or interest in class or in rural and urban capitalism is not present in The Country and the City. Late in life, Said, especially once he started to write about music, Said became very interested in Adorno. Anyone trying to write about music in a sort of social historical way is probably going to have to confront Adorno at some point. And without getting too melodramatic about it or too sentimental about it, I think as Said himself got older, faced a terminal disease, which he fought for 12 years, as the situation in Palestine, under the cover of an ostensible peace process, as the situation in Palestine got worse and worse and worse, and it has only worsened since he died, I think Adorno's sort of dramatization and living and writing about criticism in defeat, to put it bluntly, became important for him. Said was not going to be reconciled, and in Adorno he found an example of that. Said, I think, was well aware of the political or activist limitations of a writer like Adorno, but he still wanted to learn from him. I have a personal theory that I've written about and published about, that History and Class Consciousness, with its great central essay on class consciousness and reification, is an essay and a thematic that is fundamental right through Said's career. For me, I don't know what other people think about this, but I think I can argue this, and I can show you the publication where I did try to argue it. For me, from beginnings right up to Culture and Imperialism, Said executes a move at the beginning of his major books, which is one that, if you want, takes what I take to be the central message of that famous essay, that book-length essay, which is that the fundamental, the most powerful knowledge of capitalism, monopoly capitalism for Lukács, is going to be expressed in the knowledge and the class consciousness of those who are most degraded and, in fact, reified and objectified by capitalism, and that is the workers. The workers' knowledge of capital is, in fact, a potentially revolutionary knowledge that knows the system from the inside but has the potential to overturn it from within. And I think that kind of motif, maybe it is only a motif, and maybe it's a motif that ranges much further than Georg Lukács,